your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Question. Who is America's largest employer? No, it's not Google. No, it's not Apple. By far, it's the federal government. And of course, there's state and local government as well, but the federal government alone has 2 million people on the payroll, not counting 1.4 million more who are active duty military, not counting 500,000 career postal workers, and not including all the seasonal employees. And government employment, thanks to we taxpayers, you taxpayer, you listeners, is the largest remaining bastion of full-time, fully benefited employment with all holidays off and a pension. It's a concept that's atavistic, anachronistic, a pension. Plus, security of employment nonpareil. And here is the real shocker. A recent study found that in most job categories, federal pay is higher than their private sector equivalents. Yet I've had a number of clients looking for jobs who refuse to apply for a federal job. Some because they think that the federal, the government is turgid. But a lot of them these days because they so hate President Trump. But looking in my crystal ball for what it's worth, this too shall pass. Maybe before he finishes his term. There's a hell of a lot of talk of impeachment after a Democratic win, which is projected in the midterms. Well, whether Trump finishes his term or not, I doubt he's going to run again. Thanks to the nonpareil job security in federal jobs, long after he's gone in Mar-a-Lago, you, as a federal employee, will still be there. But how does a person land that bonanza of employment, a federal job? With me to provide the answers is Nancy Siegel. Following a 30-year career as a federal HR specialist, for more than a decade now, she has been offering advice on how to land a federal job. She's also the author of 4 books on the subject, including The Complete Guide to Interviewing for a Federal Job and the new 3rd edition of The Complete Guide to Writing a Federal Resume. Nancy Siegel, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. I'm happy to be here.
Great.
And let me correct one comment that you made.
Already I've screwed up.
If I may.
Already I've screwed up. I haven't even started yet. Go ahead.
Am I allowed?
Of course you are. This is honesty radio here.
Okay, well then you've been reading the Hoover Institute reports on federal salaries, because actually what most of the salaries show is that people in the low to middle career fields and levels, those folks tend to make more than the private sector. But people who are really highly technical, highly specialized, your scientists, your doctors, your cybersecurity people, they actually make less.
And I will already start arguing with you because I'm not relying on the Heritage Foundation or any other foundation. The federal government's own study this year found that except at the PhD level, that salaries are higher for the same work in the federal government. But we digress. Let us start to the more substantive issue of, you told me that older people and people of color may have a better chance of getting a federal job than elsewhere. What makes you say that?
Well, if you look at the demographics of the federal government spread by gender, race, age, you will see that in virtually every category, the federal sector has a higher percentage of people of color, women in professional positions, people over the age of 40, which is where EEOC draws the line for old. Yes, well, I resemble that remark. In fact, over 45% of federal employees are over the age of 50.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I often hear from people, they're very worried, they have a second career, they're concerned, particularly if they're coming from the private sector, about age discrimination. And honestly, lots and lots of people come to the government for second and third careers, so I would not let that stop you.
Yeah, that indeed comports with my experience. But one of the things that everybody agrees is that we think of, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, we think about the federal and any government job application process being extremely formal. Indeed, it's often quantitative. Everybody gets a score and points, and that the application process is so structured that even though the standard career counselor advice is network, 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 that networking won't help as much in landing a federal job as if you were trying to get a job in a company, a nonprofit. What is the truth of the matter?
So the truth of the matter is that getting a federal job is not a natural act. There is a highly structured process, and everybody funnels through a gatekeeper. And those gatekeepers are human resources or HR personnel. So while I'm not opposed to networking, the people who say to me, oh, well, I have a friend and he promised, the truth of the matter is if you cannot get past the HR people, then the people you know and have networked with cannot help you. So the process is structured. There is an application process. And they still call it an application as opposed to even a resume, although a resume is obviously part of it. There is typically a multiple choice questionnaire that could have anywhere from 10 to 50 questions. And unless you come through that process with the optimal score, then no one at the hiring level, the actual hiring manager, will even see your stuff.
I see. So in other words, if I've got a friend who is a hiring manager, and she's my friend and or whatever, and if she goes and makes a call to HR and say, you know, I really particularly like to take a look at this particular employee, she or he doesn't have that authority, it's really the power resides in the HR person?
Well, your friend can ask all she likes. But the HR people are really the gatekeepers. And unless you can come through the system, the HR people cannot just pluck you out of the pile.
Okay. Let's turn then to, you know, the other thing that we are aware of is that most of the federal jobs are on usajobs.gov.
Correct.
Is there a need to look beyond? I mean, obviously there's going to be some jobs that are going to be only on the individual agency's website, some urgent job or whatever, and some will be on LinkedIn, a few. But in general, for somebody, you know, the typical job seeker only has a certain amount of emotional energy. They're not going to go searching forever. Is it enough to focus pretty much there? If you're interested in a federal job, you focus on usajobs.gov, or is that wrong?
So if you focus on usajobs.gov, that will take you to 90% of the federal jobs.
Okay.
The jobs that are outside of USA jobs would be the intelligence community.
Mm.
Okay. That's a very small percentage of the country. Some of the overseas jobs, like for foreign nationals and things like that. But the bulk of it, you're going to be fine with USA Jobs.
Okay.
The key thing, though, on USA Jobs, couple of things people should keep in mind.
Great.
Thing number one is they need to make sure they complete their USA Jobs profile properly, because that is what the federal HR people use to determine someone's eligibility.
Now, is that profile normally is spoken of as a resume that's 4 to 6 pages? Is that the federal resume, or is that something else?
That's something else.
Okay.
When you sign up for USA Jobs, it will ask you a whole bunch of questions.
Okay.
And answering those questions correctly is key. and a particular piece of it that everyone should pay attention to is their various hiring eligibilities. So as an example, if you are a military veteran, there are multiple ways in for you as a vet. But if you don't check the right boxes,
sure,
and upload the requisite paperwork, no one is going to say, gee, I noticed on his resume that he qualifies for this, but he didn't fill it out. We'll take care of him. That is not the goal.
Okay. There's been, you know, especially on the station, there have been a number of shows that are focused on prisoner rights, drug abuse, people who have drug conviction rights, etc. You say give the right answers to the question. If somebody has been incarcerated, and if somebody, let's say, has been institutionalized for a drug problem, or you know, dry out program, or whatever, can they expect to be hired, and B, do those kind of affirmations get verified?
Let's start with the second question, and that is they absolutely get verified. Do not lie, because you will be caught. Now, can you get hired with a conviction? Yes. There's an asterisk, of course, as with everything. The asterisk involves what job are you applying for, and how relevant is your conviction to that job? How long ago was it? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so it's not an immediate exclusion.
It is absolutely not an immediate exclusion. I've had clients with who have served their sentences who have gotten federal jobs.
Okay.
So it's doable.
Okay. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Nancy Siegel about how to land a federal job. It is, you know, to me, it's, you know, when I started doing career counseling 30 years ago, you know, it was not the job of choice. There were far, you know, many private sector employees and nonprofit employers would be paying, you know, full-time jobs, benefits and holidays and vacations. That has rapidly eroded. And now it really does seem like, unless you're a superstar, I mean, if you're a superstar, then everybody, the private sector, the nonprofit sector will genuflect before you and pay you whatever. But if you're a normal human being, you're mortal, then really you're most likely, there's no guarantees in either sense, but your most likely path to that holy grail of full-time benefited employment is the government, especially the federal government, because they have so much taxation power, they can always either raise taxes or increase the deficit. We're now at $21 trillion in the federal deficit. Nancy, am I correct, though, that as in the private sector, the government gets many applicants for each position? How competitive actually is it to land most, not the unusual, but the typical, say, analyst job? That's your kind of your basic professional job in the federal government.
So most federal job postings receive anywhere from 400 to 1,000 or more applications.
No, for one job? You have a better chance of winning the lottery.
Which is why it is so critical, number one, that you fill out your USA Jobs profile correctly. And let me add one thing that I think many people are hesitant to disclose, but can actually be quite beneficial for individual applicants, and that is a disability.
Yeah, I know.
And when many of us think about disabilities, we have a vision in our mind. But as all of us, present company included, get younger, thinner, and more beautiful, more and more of us have stuff that would qualify as a disability. And if you qualify as having a disability that still allows you to work, and we could be talking about things like depression, anxiety, diabetes too, you know, in addition to the more traditional way we think about disabilities, that makes you eligible to be hired without competition.
Wow. It almost seems like Alice in Wonderland. So in other words, if you've got depression and diabetes, you have a better chance of getting being one of that 400 to 1,000 people to get hired than if you don't have depression?
Well, it depends on your individual circumstances, of course. But that's why taking a look at that USA Jobs profile, really assessing your best way in, and making sure that you check all those correct boxes for maximum consideration is really huge.
So what, I mean, I'm trying to picture my listeners who are listening, who would like a federal job. We've just done such a good job of touting its wonders and how a wonderful thing it is. And now you tell me, A, that there are 400 to 1,000 people applying for every job, and B, if I am a listener and I don't have cancer and I don't have diabetes and I don't have depression, then my chances are one in a million?
No. I mean, you may qualify for other ways in.
Like
I'm
what?
Just trying to give people the broad range of possibilities.
What are some other ways in that, you know, you're more...
Someone could be, you know, military members, of course, get hiring preference. Military spouses get hiring preference. There are a wide range of other sorts of possibilities. If you are a cybersecurity professional, as an example, that is a special hiring authority. There are folks who are contracting people who would be eligible.
One more question. I'm going to interrupt you. I'm getting it. Yeah. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have interrupted you. Please continue.
A former Peace Corps and VISTA or AmeriCorps volunteers. We may have some of those on listening to your show.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a variety of ways in, and while it is not impossible to get a job without any of those, I don't want your listeners to overlook some of these specialty categories that they may fit into.
Wow. So if my, you know, I always try to, one of my rules of radio is that I try to put myself in the shoes of the typical listener. It's about 7,000 people listening to the show now. And the most common category are people who have a bachelor's degree, mm-hmm. usually in a social science, in sociology or psychology or women's studies or African American studies or whatever. They are healthy. They are fortunate. They don't have diabetes yet or severe depression or whatever. What do you, if you're talking specifically to that largest group of my listeners who are between 30 and 60 and have those characteristics, and they are, you know, they have soft skills. They're not super high tech, but they're not technologically ignorant either. They're in the middle. You're talking specifically to that pool. What do you honestly say to them to give them wise advice? Should they forget about a federal job? Should they consider themselves? How do they get around the fact that you're telling them one out of 400 to one out of 1,000 get a job? And, you know, it really helps if you're in one of those special categories. How do my listeners wrap their heads around that?
So let's take your social scientists, psychologists, social workers, the Department of Veterans Affairs has lots of hiring programs, and there are not enough social workers in the universe to meet the needs of the VA hospitals, and they have special hiring programs as well. So really what I would tell your listeners is to do their homework to figure out where they want to work, to really research, and there are books out there to help people, as well as people like me and others, to really figure out where they might fit, and then strap in, because it is a process. We haven't even gotten to the resume yet.
Mm. So the process, it can take a year. Is that accurate?
Yes. I tell people, while it could certainly happen in, you know, 6 months or less, the vast majority of people should focus on thinking it will take 6 to 18 months.
6 to 18 months. Okay, yep. Let's very... You know what I think I want to do? You mentioned your book, so the least I could do is tell our listeners know that you have written a number of said books. One is called The Complete Guide to Interviewing for a Federal Job, and the new third edition of The Complete Guide to Writing a Federal Resume. What a lovely segue into talking about the federal resume. But I think I'd like to invite the listeners to call in with a question if they have a question or comment for you. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, if you or someone you love is either interested in getting a federal job or has one and wants to talk about it, something, anything you want to ask or tell Nancy Siegel, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Okay, give me the world's shortest course in what it takes to become, to have your federal resume levitate to the top of a 400 to 1,000 person pile.
Okay, so first thing, that accurate USA Jobs profile we talked about.
Right.
Second thing, making sure that you apply for jobs for which you are truly qualified. So what that means is that it's not about knowing you can do a job. It's about proving that you already have. So every job is posted. That's a requirement. Read those postings. You should pay attention to a couple of things on those postings. You should pay attention to who can apply. And if you don't fit in that category, don't apply. You should pay attention to what is called specialized experience requirements. This is where the government is telling you exactly what they're looking for in terms of qualifications. If you don't have that, move on. There's 10,000 jobs posted every day. Chances are you will find something.
That really raises a question. Now, again, I'm thinking of another segment of my listenership, which is the new college graduate, or heaven forbid they don't have a college degree. They're not going to have all that. I'm sorry, what?
90% of federal jobs do not require a degree.
Wow. So, okay. So that's a first piece of good news for some of my listeners. So, if I don't have much, but you're saying you have to have the documented experience, but let's say now I am that pool of people who doesn't have a degree. Maybe I went to San Francisco State for 2 years or a community college and I dropped out, and now I'm looking at these federal jobs, and Nancy Siegel's telling me, you better have all that specialized experience because, you know, does somebody without a lot of work experience have a shot at being the one in 400 to 1,000 gets hired?
So there are student and recent graduate programs. There are internship programs. There's programs for recent grads.
Good. Where do I find out about those? Is there a place on the web that will help my listeners find those?
USA Jobs.
Okay.
Again, you can set up what's called a search agent because no one wants to troll through.
Right.
Maybe the Russians. No one wants to troll through 10,000 jobs on any given day.
Right.
So you can set up criteria. And have USA Jobs automatically send you job postings that meet those criteria. So it could be by hiring program. It could be by location. It could be by salary. It could be by occupation. So if your listeners, set up their search agents, they'll start to see these student programs that we're talking about.
Okay. You know, as I many people think that almost all or most of the federal jobs are in D.C., and yet we have two huge federal office buildings that are federal buildings alone in Oakland, a huge one in San Francisco. What percentage of jobs are in D.C.? And do you have any idea what percentage of jobs are in the San Francisco Bay Area?
So I don't have San Francisco specifically, but 79% of federal jobs are located outside of D.C.
Good. Okay. Interesting.
And California has 250,000 federal jobs.
Wow. California's 250,000 federal jobs. And dear listeners, don't forget about state employment, county employment, city employment, and then there are endless numbers of what are called interstitial agencies, from the Metropolitan Transportation Commission to the Water Commission to the Parks Commission. So don't let the 400 to 1,000, one in a 400, one out of 400, one in a 1,000 to deter you. Government remains the biggest hire and certainly the last large bastion of fully benefited employment with great job security. I'm going to just ask you one last, softball question. If there was one more thing that you wanted to tell our listeners that would help them to land a federal job, maybe about the interview process, which we have not covered, what would be the one more thing that is not obvious that you'd like to share with my listeners?
The one thing that is not obvious that I don't think we've covered is that if you want to write a resume that will get you a federal job, forget everything you have ever heard about a resume being one or two pages. A typical federal resume runs 4, 5, or 6 pages, and there is a lot of required information you would never, ever put on a private sector resume that if it's not on your federal resume, you can be eliminated. And it's important to understand that unlike the private sector where the readers will make assumptions, from the federal perspective, if it's not on your resume, you did not do it. So as an example, I get calls from people with big titles, directors or vice presidents or whatever, and they say things, and I ask them, did you supervise anyone? And they take great umbrage. I can almost see them over the phone putting their shoulders back and their chest out, and they say things, well, I'm a director, of course I supervise people, or some variation on that theme. But from a federal perspective, if it's not on your resume, no one will make that assumption.
Is there something not obvious that would go on a federal resume that you said you would never put it on your private resume? Obviously, if you're writing a private resume, you would put, in fact, that you've had leadership management experience of people. But what might occur in that 4 to 6 pages of federal resume that you say would never in a million years be seen on a private sector resume?
How many hours a week you work? The name of your supervisor? Your salary?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for working for no salary, for being on this show, Nancy Siegel. Her book, by the way, what do you want to tout? Do you want to tout your consulting business, helping people who are looking for federal jobs, your books? What would you like to share with us, as they say?
Well, I would certainly like to tout my book and my weekly blog, which has a lot of information about how to get a federal job.
Right.
And that is available at fedweek.com. Okay. And if people want to reach out to me, they can do so at nancy@solutions-workplace.com.
I'll repeat that. Nancy at solutions with an S-workplace.com. Nancy Siegel, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, Marty.
Take care. And now, we will turn to you. One of the core functions of this show are to do what I call workovers, things that are individually relevant to you, whether you are things, not just things, I'm talking about work-related problems, whether you're 16 or 76, whether your work problem is that you're curled up in a ball with a joint and can't get out of bed, or you are a highly powerful CEO, for-profit or non-profit, and are still unhappy with your work life. Any kind of work problem, to be candid with you, the more difficult, the better, because I have been doing this on this show for 28 and a half years, and I like challenging problems, and I think our listeners do too. So if you've got a work-related problem, the phone number, while before the lines get crowded, the phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I love to tweet. Tweeting for me kills two birds with one stone. One is that it allows me to share instantly with a fairly large number of followers my best ideas. And the other thing it enables me to do is it's a repository of those ideas, which I can then quickly search and kind of curate to find the ones that I think would serve you, my dear listeners. So while I'm waiting for calls to come in, I am going to share with you some of my recent tweets that I hope are worthy of your attention. Number one. We criticize perfectionism as causing procrastination. We say, you know, he's such fear of perfectionism that he procrastinates, doesn't do it. And yet many people's perfectionism, their perfectionist efforts, have yielded the most good. Should we really discourage perfectionism? That was the question. That was one I raised. I'll do two more and then we'll go to the phones. From ancient Greece to today's pulpit, the message is moderation. But is that not a formula for mediocrity? The people who were not moderate, who strove for excellence, more often than not, are the ones who made the greatest accomplishments. Just a thought. Not everybody can be, but I like to question the conventionalism. And the third tweet is, become a go-to guy, or gal, of course, at something. It is excellence and accomplishment that makes you like your job, not so much whether it's in a cool field. I'll give out the phone number again before we go to the phones. If you or someone you love has got a work-related problem of any sort, for-profit, non-profit, certainly. Oh, and you know what I would love to do? Here's what I'm going to do. I love stories. I was watching a beer commercial, and the beer commercial said, everyone has a story. And that just clicked into my brain. Everyone does have a story. If you want to tell me your work-life story, it could start anywhere in your life. It could start from the lemonade stand. It could start last week. But if you want to tell your story, you don't have to call with a problem. If you want to tell your story, that's another good reason to call. So whether you got a problem or you got a story, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I'm going to do two more things. Forgive me for being so nonlinear. The next three people who call are going to get a free copy of my book. And all you're going to need to do is if you call in and you get on the air, after the show is over, you can email me. Just email me your mailing address to mnemko, that's M-N-E-M-K-O, at comcast.net. And I'm always on the honor system. So, you know, I won't know your names, but just the first three people, just email me. And the final thing is, on May 1st, at 7 o'clock at night, I think, what I've got, yeah, whatever May 1st comes out on, because I am such a believer in storytelling, I am having a storytelling evening at my home, in which I will read you some of the stories from my newest book called Modern Fables, and invite you to tell your stories or read your stories. So if you're interested in coming to that, you can also email me at mnemko@comcast.net, M-N-E-M-K-O. @comcast.net. Some people think I'm crazy. Oh, you're opening up your home? You're giving out you're inviting people to your home? I've been doing variations like this for decades. You know what? When you treat people well, they treat you well too. I have never been burned. So it is my honor to invite you to my home. Again, my email address, mnemko@comcast.net. And now, the phone number if you want to work over, and you maybe want a free copy of the book, 415-841-4134. Now let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello, it's you. Are you there? That person is not there. I can hear dead air. Are the person there now? No, the person is gone. We've lost that person. Okay. So we'll turn the lemons into lemonade. I'll give it the phone number again. 415-841-4134 is the number. I think the person is back. I think we'll just wait a moment, and let's see if we can invoke the magicians of technology and get that person on the air. Okay, welcome to the show. You're on the air. Oh, now I hear you. Welcome to the show. It's your turn. How can I help you?
Hi.
Hello.
I've got a problem with one of my independent contract jobs. I'm not really sure what to do with it. Okay. So the office manager is pretty much difficult to work with, I should say. I don't have to say the name of the business, do
I? Not at all, no.
Okay. So, long story short, she went on maternity leave, and she was still very, very much involved with the business, and she works remotely from home. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of stepping in and helping out with the business and scheduling and that sort of thing. So, and then we started noticing some problems with the office manager communicating with certain staff and just not being very professional and just saying kind of crude comments and things of that sort. So we went to the doctor about it, that owns the business, mm-hmm. and we pretty much just said, you know, we're having this issue and pretty much nothing's being done about it. And currently, right now, my work is being taken away from me.
What do you think is the reason why, you know, doctors, of course, want, like everybody else, want to have their practice running smoothly. Why did the doctor feel that he or she believes that the office manager, just because they may use crude language, I've been known to use some crude language myself, did it feel like it was justified that the person is nonetheless competent? What was the doctor's rationalization for doing nothing about it?
She pretty much likes her because she organizes her and keeps her on top of things, and this person's very good at their job.
Uh-huh.
But, however, they're a type A personality, and uh-huh. they want things done a certain way.
Yes.
And they're beyond micromanaging. It's like, you know, do this way and do it that way, but when you do it her way, it's still wrong. So she's just impossible to work with.
So I want to ask the really hard question. You say she's very good at her job, and yes, some people who are very type A, and Barbara Streisand was well known for being a type A, but she created, as a director, some of the finest movies and the finest albums that have ever been created, and it is her type A behavior and insistence that made it so great. Is it possible that the problem, is it possible that the problem resides in you? And if she's that competent and they're cutting back your hours, is it possible that you need to look inward and say, how can I either up my skills or my detail-orientedness or whatever, or is this job simply inappropriate for me? What would the goddess within you say?
That's what I've been deciding, and other people have been having the same issue with her, and she'll say something like, for example, if something's been scheduled by another scheduler, she'll jump in and say, well, that email was just garbage. And I don't think that's very appropriate, you know, to talk to your workers that way. And she's been known to be rude to clients and things of that sort. So what I've been doing is just kind of cutting back on hours and, you know, going to other jobs because I have multiple jobs.
I'm going to interrupt you. You know, one of the things, there is a style versus substance thing. And of course, we wish that everybody was, a super competent person and also extremely tactful. But there are few perfect human beings on the planet, and so it's like a professor. Some professors, you know, may, for example, not be the clearest speakers, but they really have so much to teach. They have great wisdom or whatever. Is it correct that just because, like, I have met people who curse like a sailor, who may be rude, but there's a lot I can gain from. On the other, are you being too insistent on style over substance? And I won't push it one more time, but that's my last thought. What do you really think about that?
Overall, I think that this job is pretty much, it's stressful for me.
Okay.
Overall, just dealing with her and how things are run of that sort, because it's got to be done her way.
Right.
And she's pretty much has the business owner wrapped around her finger.
Right.
So
she's not
going to
change
something.
Yeah. So so is it correct that not only should you cut back your hours? I tried to probe go the other way, but let's say I said, you know, you need to leave that. You know, quit. You say you've got other contracts. You can work in other offices. Are you feeling resistant, relieved, happy? What's your emotion when I say you need to leave that job? Let's just say it's a poor fit.
I think the line of work that I do keeps me in with this position, and I don't want to fully let it go. But on a financial level, it's not reasonable for me to stay. So you are right about that. I would agree.
So if I said that the next thing, since you say, because it's financially not feasible for you to quit, so if I said quietly, start looking for another job so you could replace it, and knowing that there is another job, you know, that you're going to be looking for another job, could make you a little more impervious to her cursing or her demeaning or saying, that's garbage, you know? And so it's like a balm. It's like a salve. How do you feel about starting to look, and what do you think about that plan?
I would disagree about looking for a different job because I already have two other jobs.
Okay.
Can
you afford not to? Well, you were saying you financially couldn't afford to leave. That's why I said that.
Well, I mean, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to put this job on the back burner so that it's more just pocket money and it's not really reliant on you know, say for rent or something.
I'm confused. If you're saying it's just for pocket money and you hate her and it's very stressful, why would you want to endure that torture for pocket money? I'm not getting it.
Well, going back, this job was primarily my main source of income. So it was paying for the big bills, and it was a reliable job while she was on maternity leave. But now it's sort of just kind of taken a back seat because of I'm not getting enough business. So I'm trying to transition that back to, you know, hey, you know, this job is just going to be a whatever job. So I'm going to gravitate to my other jobs and have that as primary, if that makes any sense.
Well, sounds like you've made up, you know, that sounds like it's the plan you originally called with, and it's the plan you're going to be ending this call with. So I think I'm just going to thank you for the call. And, you know, I wish you less stress. I can certainly say there certainly are enough doctors around so that let me ask you this. Would the goddess within you say, what are your greatest strengths and greatest weaknesses so that your next job is more likely to be one where the person is not going to be even tempted to curse at you?
I think overall, just standing up for myself for whatever situation I'm in, that's always been a challenge with me. But in a job situation, I think it tends to be a little bit tougher because... You know, the person's intimidating, or I just hate confrontation overall, but I know it's something that I have to deal with overall.
Not necessarily. There are some jobs where you know, if you're doing the job well and the person's, you know, some people are just always mean. You know, there's a certain percentage of people who are just always mean and angry and whatever. But most people are mean under certain circumstances and nice under other circumstances. Is it the kind of work you're doing that where you know that even if the person had a temper, because you do that kind of work well, that person's not going to lose their temper with you? Is there a certain kind of work that you know you do well enough that it's not going to trigger anybody?
Oh, absolutely. One of my jobs is exactly that. Like, there's no stress. The people I work with are awesome. That's why I'm gravitating towards that job mainly. And I'm happy overall, so I just kind of needed a second brain to look at this to make sure that I'm going the right direction.
Well, your answers are implying that there's no way you can get. You say you've got enough good skills. Other people will hire you. They're happy. You're making only pocket change with this. She's a monster. You're getting stressed out. I mean, you know, it doesn't take a genius to say, get your butt out of there.
Yeah. All right. There's just a lot of self-doubt in me, though, you know?
Yeah. So. Anyway, I'm going to thank you for the call. I will give out the phone number again. If you want me to torture you, or sometimes I'm nice where I can, tough where I must be. The phone number for what I call a workover with no pummeling usually involved, any kind of work-related problem, I love to hear it. I really do live to help people. That really is my mission in life. I can sound flip, but I'm really serious about it. So if you need some help, the price is certainly right. Zero, thanks to KELW, and this is my pro bono work, my volunteer work. So you can call. This is the time to call. Phone number 415-841-4134. That's the number to call if you've got a work problem. Or, as I offered earlier, if you want to tell your story, everybody has a story, their work-life story, maybe the progression of your career through your life, or simply a sliver of that. The phone number again, 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hey, Marty. How's it going?
I am well. What gives me the honor of the call?
Hey, this is Michael. How's it going?
Good.
Excellent.
What's your problem?
So I currently work here down in the Bay Area. My industry is primarily in the Bay Area as well. And my wife and I decided about 6 months ago to move up to the Sacramento area to be closer to family and also lower cost of living. And basically, I've been commuting back and forth since then, on average 2.5-3 hours each way.
Jesus. Wow. Let's stop the thing. The traffic is crazy. It takes me 1 hour and 15 minutes to get here from Oakland to this radio show. And I only do that once a week. You do it 2.5 to 3 hours each day, each way?
So I was for a little bit and figured, you know, just couldn't handle that. So decided to, get a place down here during the week, go back up on the weekend. And I'm about 35 years old, and my wife and I are wanting to start to have our family and things like that as well. So it's been a tough balance between, you know, work and life and going for personal goals, yet still working on my career and trying to, make some sort of a change. Like, for myself and for my family, I can't continue going this direction.
Right.
So, I've been applying up in the Sacramento area for different positions, different roles. Something you said earlier, it's not necessarily the dream job or dream industry, but, what you put into it and what you do with it. And where I'm at in my career, I'm probably mid-level management, closer to upper management. And anywhere seems like I've been applying, they love my resume, they love my years of experience, the certificates and licenses that I have gotten. But I don't have any experience in industries up more in that region. So it's been very difficult to even get in the door for an interview or, get past, sending in my resume with, numerous other individuals.
Right. I'm not sure. Maybe it's just a recency effect because I just had a guest on the show talking about government jobs. But you made the move to Sacramento. Again, the biggest employer in Sacramento is the state. And there is, to forgive the cliched word, there is a diversity of employment there that's enormous. And if you've got these various licenses, remember what the guest talked about, you have to have the licenses. You have to have this background. So whatever you've done, if, let's say, you've been a sales manager, there certainly can be a lot of, even within that, there are transferable skills, the ability to persuade, the ability to manage people, the ability to manage a process. When somebody buys a product from you, it's not just sell a product, you've got to liaise back with the factory or whatever. If you can talk about your transferable skills, that's going to be the largest corpus of jobs. The other option that comes to mind is the competition is so much less fierce in place. I'm not talking about in Sacramento, where it still could be for a good job, working for Mita Motors, that big chain of car dealers in Sacramento, or Kaiser, this bear, or Sutter Health. If you go further, like whether you go inland to Modesto, or you go to Stockton, or any other places, or even toward Tahoe or Reno, you're commuting already 3 hours. I'm wondering whether you could be a shoo-in for a really good job, either in the state or in a major set of major employers that exist in areas that are less competitive. What are your reactions to that?
Yeah. I've applied to, federal jobs. I've applied, companies like Intel up in Folsom and a few other, more regional jobs like SMUD, PG&E, things of that sort. But I'm not sure if it's like I'm not curtailing my resume properly or, because it doesn't even seem like I'm getting past that initial view of the resume into, an actual interview where I can, build on my skills that are transferable to, say a middle to upper management position.
Michael, this is a vomitious statement, but it's true. Unlike my previous guest talked about the fact that for federal jobs, apparently networking is not going to be very helpful. But we all know that when, there are dozens of people applying or more applying for every job, it does matter who you know. You have to be a competent person. But have you done enough, since you've relatively recently moved to Sacramento, have you really done enough to build connections with people who are in a position to hire you, either by joining organizations, being on nonprofit boards, getting involved in a church in a relatively high income area where people are well employed, or you talked about Intel. Are there local either online or in person chapters of technology management or technology leadership organizations? Should you find somebody at those major companies in Stockton, in Lodi, in Folsom, in Auburn, in whatever, or even in Tahoe, and reach out to them through LinkedIn or through by following them on Twitter, by emailing them directly, by phoning them? Have you done enough to try to lay the foundation so that you're not just submitting, because you're sounding despondent, and if you are submitting resumes and it's not getting you anywhere, it means you're not having anybody pushing for you. If I said you need to redirect your efforts to trying to build in either your existing network, if you know people, you've been there, it sounds like a little while, so you have some existing network. I don't know if you fully tapped that enough, or even if you have previously, is it time to go back to them, or is it time to expand your network, either a personal network, as I said, people through a volunteer organization, a political organization, a church, getting on a volunteer board, or directly to target employers. By the fact that you mentioned Intel, I'm assuming you're kind of in the tech world. Looking at the tech companies that are based somewhere within a reasonable radius of Sacramento and finding key players in that space, have you done enough to systematically identify and nurture relationships with those people?
No, I have not.
You gave me
quite a few options, though. I appreciate that.
And if you're honesty in your heart of hearts, Michael, if we were in Las Vegas, or in Tahoe, and we could bet that you would, with vigor, pursue at least some of these strategies, should we bet that you would, or would you resist, procrastinate, and, you know, what, Michael, do you really think you would do? Should we bet on you or not bet on you?
Yeah, no, I would bet on it, totally.
Okay. Then your butt is going to be, next week, your butt is going to be by your phone again, and you're going to call me on this very radio show. And I want to see if you're full of it or you really do follow through. Because I've now given you about 10 minutes of airtime on this show. And you are now accountable to my butt, boy. How's that sound?
I love it.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thanks, Marty.
Take care. Bye-bye. Anyway, I'll give out the phone number. See, I can't, you know, I can be, it's a tough love, but it's kind of with a lilt. So if you could need a kick in the ass, or you want some gentle, nurturing, supportive, kind counsel, any of those reasons, you got a work-related problem, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And before, I always wanted to prioritize you, my dear listeners, but I was also sharing with you some of my tweets that I think are particularly relevant to you in your work life. I try to tweet about the things that I think are important but not obvious. This is one I really love. This is a quote. All the rest of the stuff I've been telling you is my own stuff. But this, of all things, comes from a play by Neil Simon. The play is called Broadway Bound, which I think is his favorite play. It is my favorite play. I think it's his best play. The quote is, "The smilers get to be the salesmen. The smilers get to be the bosses. The smilers got all the girls. Your father paid a price for not being a phony." I want to give a tip of the cap to all the non-smilers in the work world. Everybody likes a jokester. Everybody likes a fun guy, a fun woman. But, you know, the quiet, introverted, serious person who does their job doesn't get enough credit. And I just wanted to read that tweet, that quote, in the service of those who are not bombastic. Next tweet. "Recent graduates feel like imposters because they are. Whether a bachelor's degree or an MD or a JD, that's a law degree, or an MBA, universities, especially prestigious ones, paradoxically, focus on theory or narrow practicalities. That's why even top law firms have training programs for new associates. When my daughter graduated from Yale Law School, the preeminent law school in the nation, and got hired by Supreme Court Justice Powell's law firm, they have a 2-year training program for those new graduates because Yale Law School taught them squat about anything practical. That's why MDs, I do teach at UCSF Medical School, why MDs need a 3-to-7-year residency after they spent $300,000 in 4 years on medical school. So do not feel bad if you have the imposter syndrome, especially as a newbie, but even if you're relatively experienced. Hopefully that's a little bit of good news, a little balm, to use a word I used earlier. One more tweet, and then I'll go back to the phones. This may surprise you. Women earned the majority of doctoral degrees in 2016 for the 8th straight year. And they outnumber men in graduate school 135-100. And I haven't heard of any affirmative action for men lately. Anyway, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a question about self-employment versus being an employee.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, and you said you work, you said you teach at UCSF. So what do you think about that for doctors? What does it depend on the personality, the field?
You're an MD?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So, you know, I have, doctors are the number one, my most prevalent client of all. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that self-employment for doctors, the small little practices, those group practices, are almost unsustainable now. There's a number of factors. The paperwork has grown from Medicare, Medicaid, insurance companies, non-paying patients. Your billing department ends up being enormous. Federal regulations, reporting requirements. It just is too much hassle. UCSF is also extremely bureaucratic. It really, you know, I would if you're my client, I ask you to first consider, unless you have this, I have a client who's a tertiary dentist who's in private practice, and he's going to be fine because he does these very complicated maxillofacial surgeries, and so he's going to be fine because he's got more clients he knows what to do with, and he actually tries to minimize the insurance. But for most docs, they'd be wiser to either work at UCSF, especially if you've got tertiary care expertise and a research agenda and funding, or if not, Kaiser Permanente, because they have a very efficient system. Their computer system is way more advanced than anybody else, including CPMC and the rest of them. That's my little quick brain dump. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction is that that's the conventional wisdom, but sometimes it doesn't apply to everybody's individual personality.
Great. Tell me more about yourself.
I graduated residency in internal medicine, and I worked for a few different groups in the Bay Area. And sometimes, you know, some doctors just want to be independent. They just want to... I know it's not very common now to run your own practice or to be in a small group, but it does allow you certain flexibility in your schedule and your work-life balance, and also not responding to the needs of administrators and that kind of thing.
Okay. I'm almost out of time, so I'm just going to give you another quick response. I'm really glad you said that. Everything is statistical probabilities, and the probabilities of that working now in the year 2018 and over the next 10 years, we've got to look at a 10-year arc, would be
right.
to leave the immediate Bay Area, where there is it is one of the few places in the Bay in the country where there's a relative oversupply of doctors. You are much more likely to be successful if you do one or both of the following: move to a less doctor intensive area, or find a niche. If you are a guy who's got a particular specialty in a certain kind of patient, even within internal medicine, obviously there's a lot of specialties. If you were to develop a niche with internal medicine, that is your best shot. And that is all the time I've got, but I'm really glad you called, because I do have a special place in my heart for doctors. So thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
Okay. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Colin Peden, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko, and I are going to profile careers in education. She's superintendent of schools. I spent a lot of time in education myself. You'll get the insider perspective. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.